accession number 19090, Reel 4.
Reel 4.
As we wound our way in trucks up the earthen road which had been hacked out of the hillside by coolie labour to Kohima, we were entirely ignorant of what was in store for us and established ourselves in Kohima without further difficulty, being glad to get up to 5,000 feet above the stifling heat of the plain. And we established ourselves in Kohima with the battalion in the middle and the two Indian battalions on either side, on either flank. We were only expecting very light Japanese forces. And then, the next day, it was all changed, and orders came up from the general commanding the Dimapur district that the battalion was to return back down the hill, 40 miles. Well, of course, our brigadier was furious about this, and he had to obey, though. And we left the meager garrison at Kohima, which consisted of an Indian state regiment, really rather an unreliable body, and various odd bodies from the convalescent depot, Kohima being a hospital area. One couldn't imagine how dismayed they must have felt to see us pulling off downhill again. However, no sooner were we down at the bottom again at Dimapur than orders came through for the brigade to move up once more. But by this time, the leading Japanese spearheads were on the outskirts of the little town. They've been delayed by some good Indian troops in the Assam Rifles and the Assam Regiment, who had been fighting rearward engagements through the Somra hill tracks. As we wound up the road again, we met crowds of frightened non-combatants fleeing down the road. The battalion was leading the brigade column, and as it approached the actual town itself, it came under heavy fire from machine guns and artillery, evacuating the trucks as quickly as possible. The battalion sprinted up the hill, overlooking the crossroads at the bottom, and established itself in positions already allotted to it. The other two battalions of brigade headquarters stayed down the road, partly because there was not enough room for them on the hill which we occupied and was later to be called Garrison Hill. Many of our vehicles had gone up in flames, But the battalion established itself in the nick of time and repelled frantic Japanese attacks. My position was near the bottom of what became known as Garrison Hill, very exposed and subjected to incessant machine gun and artillery and mortar fire. Our immediate task was picking off Japanese who had penetrated the company in front. And for me, this remained the pattern of the rest of the siege, because I had, under my command, I had the Pioneer platoon, about 25 men. I had odd bodies from the carrier platoon, which was on its way up from the Arakan, and some of those members came up with us. There were also one or two men from the convalescent depot who came to join my company. But otherwise, most of my men were out on detachment with the different rifle companies. So the mortar platoon, for instance, was heavily involved elsewhere. The signalers were also heavily involved. The motor transport drivers, of course, went back with what vehicles survived. And the battle patrol undertook the defense of battalion headquarters on the top of the hill. I was the only officer in my position. I had no officers under me who were with me. And the sergeant major took care of a lot of the odd bodies and looked after them. So the battalion entered Kohima only about 450 strong, and we were, of course, pretty thin on the ground. My positions, in fact, were round about the only defense between the forward rifle company, whichever one it was that they rotated, about 150 yards in front of me, and battalion headquarters. The garrison headquarters were also in my area. So the pattern evolved. Incessant shelling and it became extremely dangerous to walk anywhere in the open. Oh no. One occasion, a Japanese infantry gun, which they usually used very close up with their front infantry, bombarded my positions with shell after shell at very close range. And at this close range, of course, the shells arrived before you heard the bang of the gun, or the report of the gun, which was disconcerting, to say the least.
Were the Japanese suffering many casualties?
The Japanese, of course, took enormous casualties from the Bren gun fire of the rifle companies, and who had to bear the brunt of the fanatical charges which immediately took place and went on generally night after night during the course of the siege. So that, in fact, the defences, outer part of the defences, became powered up with Japanese corpses. And, of course, a good many of our own. The sheer weight of numbers threatened to overwhelm the battalion. There was no problem about food and ammunition because the area had been a supply depot, but we very soon ran out of water when the Japanese cut their only supply, the only pipe supply, that is. Luckily, a spring was discovered near my company area, and the hazardous water-carrying parties had to be organized at night to get the meager supplies possible, most of which was taken up to the casualty center, which the Japanese were subjecting continually to heavy mortar fire, killing and maiming already badly wounded men. The area became festooned with parachutes as medical supplies were parachuted down, and water. Water came down actually in the inner tubes of motor towers, but unfortunately, of course, that nearly always got punctured by bullets as soon as it landed. What unpleasant things went on. The smell of mortality mounted as days passed and bodies decomposed. Day after day our hopes were dashed when we expected some form of relief. We began, day after day, to walk about like zombies because we had no chance of sleep, or very little. The rifle companies on the perimeter were steadily pushed back by the superior numbers of the enemy, and as their casualties mounted, they were forced to give ground. The 2nd British Division was arriving down at Dimapur at the bottom of the hill and beginning to push up the road and clear roadblocks. But it took an awful long time to us, seemed to us an awful long time, before any positive results were felt.
Did the Japanese try to communicate with you in any way?
Yes, they did. In fact, they had these loud hailers at night. They tried to get the Indian soldiers in the garrison to desert by telling them that their position was hopeless and that they had English-speaking and Urdu-speaking people with loud hailers down on the track at the bottom of the hill.
Did this have any effect?
Didn't have any effect as far as I know. Certainly not on our own Indians, what I call our Indians, because we had some gunners who came into the garrison with us and some Royal Engineers who came into the garrison with us.
Going back to the Arakan, had the Japanese tried to contact you there?
In the Arakan? No, well, they did, just they wrote a letter in one case saying, "Dear Royal West Kent fellows, please find dead bodies and bury same." Which is very funny, really. They knew who we were. That was by leaving a note behind one of their positions. Anyway, to go back to Kohima, the situation got graver and graver as our numbers diminished, and it was not until the 19th of April, we gone in on the 4th of April, it was not until the 19th that the two Indian battalions in our brigade were able to fight their way into our perimeter, because their positions down the road had been relieved by the leading elements of the 2nd Division, British Division. And then it was touch and go then. The Japanese were only about 200 yards from the command post at the top, coming round from the other side.
Did you know anything about the winning of the VC by Harmon?
Sorry?
The winning of the Victoria Cross by Harmon.
Oh, yes. You've got a note of that from somebody else, have you?
Yes, well, Mr. Easton told me.
Yes. Lance Corporal Harmon's splendid action. It's in that little book, actually. I don't know where you would put that in.
But did you see it yourself or have anything to do with it?
I didn't see it happen, no. Well, you've got Donald Easton's account of that.
Yes, I have.
Do you want me to give it again? And
no.
No.
Since you didn't see it yourself.
No, I didn't actually see it, no. I didn't know about it until afterwards, anyway.
Did you?
The night of the 19th, it was arranged for the leading troops of the 2nd British Division with tanks to come up the road and relieve the garrison, certainly to relieve the West Kents. And as I made my way to the command post that evening to receive orders about withdrawing the next day, a mortar bomb burst on the front of the trench, and a fragment entered my head just above the cheekbone and lodged in the front of my, my skull, I suppose.
Your forehead.
And that, of course, knocked me out cold, and I didn't really have much interest in matters after that. I was taken to the casualty post, given a shot of morphia, and ceased really to know anything more until early the next morning. And early the next morning I came to in time to see the leading troops of the Berkshire Regiment in their nice clean new uniforms making their way up round the top of the hill, covered by a very heavy barrage from 2nd Division's artillery down the road. And soon I was being helped down the hill to the waiting ambulances, together with the remnants of the battalion who were filing down ragged and bearded, looking like scarecrows, filing down to the road where tanks were engaging enemy positions and where ambulances were taking away the wounded. Well, that really ended my experience of Kohima. I never really actually ever thought that we were going to be overwhelmed for some reason or other, because the Japanese were taking enormous casualties. So I was then evacuated wounded to a field hospital south of Dimapur, where I had an x-ray and an uncomfortable night listening to the cries of the wounded, and then again on a hospital train up to the British hospital at Shillong, where peace and quiet and cleanliness were very welcome. Now, I've said in that little book, my wound was examined by a visiting ear, nose and throat surgeon who was able to operate without cutting my face open anymore. And triumphantly he was able to remove the shell splinter from my head. When I came to after the operation, I found this interesting relic resting on the little table by me, beside my bed. This, however, I'm afraid I lost in subsequent operations. This was a pity, really, because it would have been a rather splendid souvenir. So ended the siege of Kohima for our battalion. Out of the original 450, approximately 450 who entered the garrison on April the 4th, no less than 80 had been killed and over 200 wounded. The 2nd Division, moving up, fought a series of very hard, sanguinary battles against the Japanese, who had entrenched themselves in their usual array of impregnable bunkers. The ridge at Kohima was almost impossible to outflank, and so the 2nd Division had a series of very costly frontal attacks which took place for 3 weeks before the Japanese were finally overwhelmed. The story of these battles does not actually concern the 4th Battalion, but they were very, very sanguinary, and very heavy casualties were suffered by it was a British battalion, 2 Div, by the various county regiments that represented its numbers.
What about your rejoining the West Kents?
Yes, my stay in hospital was brief, and I was soon back again with the battalion at Dimapur, where I learned that we were very soon going to go up again to help, together with the 7th Indian Division, which had in the meantime arrived as a reinforcement. I felt this with a certain feeling of dismay, I must confess, but perhaps it was just as well to go back soon. This time, the battalion was given the task of pursuing the now retreating Japanese back through the Somra Hills. Together with elements of the 7th Division. The monsoon had now arrived, and this was a very arduous and unpleasant operation. The tracks were a sea of mud. Everything had to be carried on our backs or on mules. And wherever we went, there were Japanese bodies who had died of wounds or disease, and equipment along the tracks. We came across a Japanese field hospital where the bodies lying on their stretchers had all been dispatched with a neat bullet hole through the head. And yet, you know, the Japanese fought with a dull ferocity whenever they were attacked. And could only be driven from their rearguard positions with great difficulty. There wasn't really much opportunity for light-heartedness, except on one occasion I couldn't help finding it fairly amusing. You understand that at night, absolute silence was imperative when you were in close proximity to the enemy. And so one dark night, when bangings and shoutings came from the signaller's trench near my company headquarters, I was now commanding B Company, the rifle company.